There were orders issued officially to military pilots of the United States to shoot down UFOs if they didn't land when instructed to do so.
News, science, space and the cosmos, exploring our past, our future, and the mysteries of our universe. Taking a critical look at reality and a journey to the edges of human understanding. The future is now. This is the Graylian Report with Micah Hanks.
From the high mountains of Appalachia and a bunker below ground, I am Micah Hanks, and this is the Graylian Report as we begin another week exploring the mysteries of our existence, space, science, and of course, continuing the modern Grail quest. Glad as always to be able to be your host, your guide, as we keep you company Monday nights from 6 to 8 p.m. East Coast time, worldwide around the globe via KGRARadio.com, our home here on the web. I tell you, eyes to the skies this week, ladies and gents. There has been an awful lot going on, as is always the case these days, with regard to the military's concern about UFOs. And it's going to be a special edition of the program as it relates to UFOs, because not only will we be talking about that, but we also have to remember an icon on the show this week. Indeed, we lost one of the true greats last week, the late great Stanton Friedman, a UFO researcher credited with putting Roswell on the map, and of course a lot of other things in relation to that subject. So we will be going in depth and also visiting the archives with a wonderful conversation that Stanton and I had, one of many over the years, but one that we did for our radio program well in advance even of the existence of this podcast. And so I want to be able to share that with the listeners as we remember one of the true icons of ufology. All that and more awaits. So anyway, welcome to the program. I hope everyone is doing extraordinarily well tonight. I'm doing well, highly caffeinated as always, and happy to be here. I should also report it's been an eventful last few days, too. Thursday of last week, on the road, performing with the band, and then I got up early after getting in extremely late that night, early on Friday morning, because there was a campaign stop here in Asheville by Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. And so I was down there covering that for the Middle Theory podcast, and of course a full report went out yesterday about that campaign stop. I'm looking ahead to several others as we head into 2020, and I'll probably try to make as many of those as I can, because back in 2008 I used to love that, you know, in an election year going to all the different campaign stops. Very interesting cultural experience, I'll say that much. And so after Thursday and Friday and all the eventfulness of that experience, I think most of the rest of the weekend was spent just trying to recuperate while house-sitting for a friend of mine. But I'll tell you one thing about that entire experience. The fans of Bernie Sanders will tell you that they feel the burn. Well, I came away from the experience and I can attest to that, but not maybe in the same way that they do. Because what I didn't realize that morning when it was rainy and overcast as I was leaving for the event, and of course, therefore not putting on sunscreen, was that the clouds were going to part, the sun was going to be shining, and by the time I get down there to the venue, which they actually ended up holding the event outside, out behind the venue, well, we were standing in the baking sun for several hours. And so, yeah, I came away feeling the burn all right. It was a sunburn, but nonetheless was able to get the audio and do my due diligence as a reporter covering the event. Hey, whoever is going to be making their way to Asheville in the 2020 election cycle, I will be there if I can be reporting. That's what you do if you're a podcaster, or if you're like me, if you're an old radio junkie. You know, we did a lot of that back in the days working in radio. So it was good to get back out there on the campaign trail, you might say, and have that experience after so many years, although I will definitely be packing sunscreen and taking that along in the future. Yeah, that is for sure. So, anyway, all that said, I hope you guys are doing great and that whatever you are doing, wherever you are, that your weekend was wonderful. As I mentioned in the introduction to the program, we definitely lost a true icon in UFO research just last week. And the moment I found out, I mean, many of us were scrambling, trying to get information out to one another. The very first person I called, of course, was Race Hobbs, and he had been on the phone with Jimmy Church when I called and had just gotten confirmation. And so, again, a lot of phone calls were being made that day by people trying to confirm what we feared. And what was so unusual about it, I think, was that many people had actually seen Stanton fairly recently. Now, the last time I saw him had been up in Canada at an event that his nephew, Paul Kimball, put on. And we had a wonderful time up there. Ryan Sprague was with me and our good friend Aaron Goulias, Walter Bosley, Tim Banal, Greg Bishop, of course, Holly Stevens, you know, truly a wonderful group of folks. And Stanton came out too, and at the time it had been billed as being his last lecture. He actually ended up continuing to do a few more lectures, but he had announced that year that he would be retiring. And I kind of got the feeling that seeing him there, that night actually giving his very first UFO lecture, but giving it for presumably one of the last times, and it was still really good so many decades later. But I want to do a special segment. In fact, the majority of this podcast will be remembering Stanton Friedman, and so I want to save that for a little later. Although we do have, of course, the announcement from the CBC, a newspaper article announcing his passing. They said Friedman was returning from a speaking engagement in Columbus, Ohio, when he died suddenly at the Toronto Pearson Airport on Monday night, according to his family. He was 84. And in fact, Jim Harold, my good friend, had been there with him at that event in Ohio. Now, they say a nuclear physicist by training, Friedman had devoted his life to researching and investigating UFOs since the late 1960s. He was credited with bringing the 1947 Roswell incident, the famous incident that gave rise to theories about UFOs and a military cover-up, back into the mainstream conversation. Friedman officially retired last year, but still booked speaking engagements because he loved talking about UFOs. And that according to his daughter, Melissa Friedman, who actually works for the CBC. Dad, she said, was curious about anything he didn't know about. He always was asking questions about how things worked. I think it's rare for someone to stay so engaged and curious and open-minded for a life that's that long. She remembered her father as encouraging, proud, and caring, and I certainly would concur. I mean, he was one of the most upbeat and kind people that you will meet. And I have all kinds of fond memories of my own experiences with Stan, but we'll save that for later, because right now, in addition to, of course, this news of his passing, with Stanton Friedman in mind, there is this cultural shift, I think, that we're seeing right now with regard to people's attitudes toward the UFO subject. And for many years, actually, during the height of Stan's activity, talking about that, really kind of being, in a lot of ways, an educator, a communicator, and, you know, at times I think it would even be fair to say he was a sort of evangelist in the sense that, like his daughter said, he loved talking about this subject, and even after his retirement, well up into his 80s, and quite literally up until the time of his passing, I mean, he had made it truly his life's work, but that peak period where he had really been doing a lot of his traveling, lecturing, you know, writing his books and things, UFOs were often seen as a purely pseudoscientific endeavor. This was not a subject that anybody really took seriously. And only in the last couple of years are we beginning really to see a shift. And although I think that shift has been coming for quite some time, there have been plenty of politicians, members of the military, people in the scientific community who have taken the idea of UFOs, again, whatever they might be. And that is certainly something that remains in question. There is no proof that extraterrestrials are visiting Earth per se, although that is a compelling interpretation of UFO phenomena. And no matter how clear you try to be about that subject, unfortunately, there are those hardline skeptics who, in any way, shape, or form, if you even say the word UFOs, they will attack you for it because of how stigmatized this subject has become. And Stanton was operating during a time where even the modicum of credibility that we've begun to see with the subject right now, I mean, that was remote. And nonetheless, he still stuck to his guns, and he had convictions about what he believed the phenomenon could represent, and was more than willing to debate skeptics, appear at events, talk with people, layman and scholar alike. He was truly an engaging individual. And so one thing I'm very thankful for is that as a result of his hard work, his effort, in the face of ridicule at times and having to go toe-to-toe with people who were saying there is nothing to what you're studying and it is a waste of time, I am very thankful for the fact that Stanton and his work brought him all the way up to 2019, where we have begun at very least to see a shift in terms of the way that the military and the scientific community, and tell you the truth, also the media, interpret and discuss this subject. And point in case, we might as well lead off right there with an article that appeared in The Conversation the other day by Ian Boyd. He's a professor of aerospace engineering at the University of Michigan. And he asks, why is the Pentagon interested in UFOs? And in this article, he addresses some of the very same things I was talking about there, namely the way that the idea has become so stigmatized that the true denialists among the broader skeptical contingency, in their aversion to what they perceive as a pseudoscientific subject or a kooky idea, they inadvertently dismiss something that seems to be very important. And I've actually written about this fairly recently myself, but I feel that it is important to point out that, again, because you're talking about UFOs, that does not mean that you are endorsing the idea that alien life visits Earth. And Professor Boyd talks about this in his piece right there at the conversation. Here's part of what he said. U.S. Navy pilots and sailors won't be considered crazy for reporting unidentified flying objects under new rules meant to encourage them to keep track on what they see. And yet, he said just a few years ago, the Pentagon reportedly shut down another official program that investigated UFO sightings. So he said, what has changed? Is the U.S. military finally coming around to the idea that alien spacecraft are visiting our planet? He says the answer to that question is almost certainly no. And skipping ahead, he also goes on to say that in many cases, incorrect interpretations occur because people have incomplete information or misunderstand what they are seeing. Now, he says, based on his own prior experience as a science advisor to the Air Force, kind of like J. Allen Hynek had been at one time, he said, I believe that the Pentagon wants to avoid this type of confusion, so it needs to better understand flying objects that it can't now identify. During a military mission, whether in peace or in war, if a pilot or soldier can't identify an object, they have a serious problem. How should they react without knowing if it is neutral, friendly, or threatening? Fortunately, he says, the military can use advanced technologies, and this, of course, like the Raytheon's AtFLIR system used by some of the Navy planes to film these objects. And he says we can use that to try and identify strange things that are seen in the sky. He goes on to say that situational awareness is the military term for having a complete understanding of the environment in which you are operating. And because of this, a UFO represents a gap in situational awareness. He said at the moment when a Navy pilot sees something strange during flight, just about the only thing he or she can do is ask other pilots in air traffic control what they saw in that place at that time. Now, globally, the number of UFO reportings in a year, they say, has peaked at more than 8,000. However, he says it's not known how many the military actually experiences. And this is one of those very important things. We don't know how many sightings of unknowns the military experiences. And yet, again, I argued about this fairly recently in an op-ed that I did, talking about how we need to kind of curb some of the unwarranted skepticism toward the UFO subject if the military is saying that they are interested in trying to pursue these things. Again, I have a limited set of data to work with here, too. But nonetheless, if they say that they are trying to follow up on these reports because they are concerned about these incursions into our airspace, logic would dictate that they are probably having at very least a considerable number of sightings of said aircraft or objects. So again, those of us here on the civilian level, believers, skeptics, agnostics, whatever, we don't know how often these kinds of experiences occur and what specifically that they entail. But I think that we can adduce that indeed there are enough of these experiences that the military wants to take it seriously. And so to me, for anyone to dismiss the idea that it is legitimate for the U.S. Navy or the U.S. Air Force or any branch of the military to take interest in things that they are observing and that they have logistical concerns about, to dismiss that idea and say that this is all nonsense, to me, is absurd. I mean, quite clearly, as I've outlined, due to the sensitive nature of these subjects and the fact that a lot of this information has not been made publicly, as the professor points out in the commentary he does here at The Conversation, I mean, we don't have a full data set in terms of knowledge of how often these experiences occur in the military. We don't know how often they are seeing things they can't identify, and therefore there are certain limitations to how concerned military bodies may be about these aircraft. So again, obviously there are limitations to what we know on the civilian level, but in light of that, when the military comes out and says there are things that we see from time to time, we're not making a claim to know what they are, but we feel it's important to study them. To continue to dismiss that interest by the military is to me an absurd proposition. Although people do it every day, and in large part due to the stigmatization of the subject that has continued for decades, and probably will continue for some time. So as we're seeing the shift occur very slowly, you know, again, the military is coming out and saying we don't know what they are, but we do want to study them, and then you get op-eds like this one. Now, the professor goes on to say UFOs represent an opportunity for the military to improve its identification processes. At least some of that work could be done in the future by automated systems, and potentially in real time as an incident unfolds. Military vehicles, Humvees, battleships, airplanes, and satellites alike are covered in sensors. It's not just passive devices like radio receivers, video cameras, and infrared imagers, but active systems like radar, sonar, and LIDAR. In addition, a military vehicle is rarely alone. Vehicles travel in convoys, sail in fleets, and fly in formations. And he also points out that there are satellites watching from ahead over all of the aforementioned. So he said, with these sensors, they can provide a wealth of information on UFOs, including range, speed, heading, shape, size, and temperature. Now, of course, there are some caveats, and he also points out that with so many sensors and so much data, it is difficult to take all that information and turn it into something useful. So, this is where AI comes in. He says, again, with autonomy and artificial intelligence, one possible use of these new technologies could be to combine them to analyze all the many signals as they come in from sensors, separating any observations that it can't identify. Again, keep in mind this commentary being provided by a guy who was a former science advisor to the U.S. Air Force, talking about all the ways that sensors, AI, and advanced technology can be used to study UFOs. He said, in those cases, the system could even assign sensors on nearby vehicles or orbiting satellites to collect additional information in real time. Then it could assemble an even more complete picture. But for the moment, though, he said, people will need to weigh in on what all the data reveal. And that's because a key challenge for any successful use of artificial intelligence is building trust or confidence in the system. And he says, so until humans basically understand UFOs better, we won't be able to teach computers about them. In my view, he says, however, in concluding, the Navy's new approach to reporting UFO encounters is a good first step. This may eventually lead to a comprehensive, fully integrated approach for subject identification involving the fusion of data from many sensors through the application of artificial intelligence and autonomy. Only then, he says, will there be fewer and fewer UFOs in the skies because they won't be unidentified anymore. So again, without making claims to knowing what the UFOs are, I think it is important to study them. Science can be applied, and there are plenty of scientists and people with the military who are coming forward and saying, yes, this is a subject well worthy of study. That is important, I think, and we need to get past the old stigma of UFOs are silly, therefore anybody who makes the claim that there is worth to study of them is foolish. Quite the contrary, in my opinion, the only thing that's foolish as it relates to UFOs right now is to completely dismiss the subject out of hand. Now, that brings us to an editorial that appeared in The Hill by Chris Mellon, who is with the To the Stars camp. And despite my criticisms of To the Stars, which I think are necessary, I'm very concerned about the fact that they are moving their endeavors over onto the History Channel, as we've reported previously. So I definitely have my concerns about that, and I'm cautious in my approach. But I also understand that Chris Mellon, being one of the representative members of that team, when he's writing about this subject, he is speaking himself from a background in government, particularly working in the world of defense. And I'll read here from his bio there at The Hill. Mellon served 20 years in the federal government, was Deputy Assistant Defense Secretary for Intelligence from 1999 to 2002, and for Security and Information Operations from 1998 to 1999. From 2002 to 2004, he was Minority Staff Director of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence under Senator John Rockefeller. He is a National Security Affairs Advisor to the To the Stars Academy, as we know, and of course a consultant to History's nonfiction series Unidentified Inside America's UFO Investigation, which premieres later this month. So, in my opinion, there's some good and there's some bad, but you can't say that the guy has no experience in government. And this is what Chris wrote for The Hill. He said, since 2015, dozens of Navy F-18 fighter jets have encountered unidentified aerial phenomenon, once commonly referred to as UFOs, off the east coast of the United States, some not far from the nation's capital. Now, note right there, once commonly referred to as UFOs, he continues to use UAP. This has been an ongoing sanitization process. Why? Because sadly, that subject, like I have continued to say, has been so badly stigmatized by people over the years, and there is a concerted effort by people like Mellon and others to try and reintroduce the subject in a way that the general public can find it and take it to be credible. Now, again, he goes on to say here, encounters have been reported by other military aircraft and civilian airliners elsewhere in the U.S. and abroad, too, including videos shot by airline passengers. He continues here saying that what these UAPs were and who was flying them, whether friends, foes, or unknown forces, remains a mystery. Yet, careful examination of the data inevitably leads to one possible disturbing conclusion. Are you ready for this? A potential adversary of the United States has mastered technologies we do not yet understand to achieve capabilities we cannot yet match. That's right, not alien spaceships, not extraterrestrials, not time travelers from the future, but a potential enemy of the United States. as in another government. Now, keep in mind, again, it's not to say that any of those more speculative theories about what UAP could represent should all be thrown out the window. Chris Mellon is merely saying to the contrary that, look, one possible interpretation could be a threat to our national security from a foreign government. And since that is one of the possibilities, that has to be explored. It has to be taken seriously until we can rule that out and that threat is no longer on the table. That's essentially what he's arguing here. Now, he says it is long past time for Congress to discover the answers to those questions and to share at least some of its conclusions with the public. I won't read the entire thing here, but the fundamental point is being made right there. I don't know how much more plain it could be made. When skeptics are ready to double down and make fun of the UFO subject, and meanwhile people who have more than two decades of experience in government are saying, look guys, don't forget that as silly as many people make this out to be, one interpretation of said phenomena that the U.S. Air Force and the U.S. Navy are very concerned about is that an enemy nation could be watching us and using technology that we certainly don't have. We need to take that seriously. However you choose to approach the UFO phenomena, and whatever it is that interests you about it, again, we can't take that alternative, that possibility that Chris Mellon is talking about here, off of the table, and therefore we must at very least approach the subject with cautious concern. Now, by the same token, there's also no evidence that suggests that these things are in any way a threat to us. They have never exhibited what is overtly considered to be threatening behavior, and thereby I don't think that we need to be concerned per se. To point out the fact that there is a security concern that is associated with UFOs due to our incomplete data set about them is not to say that they are therefore dangerous. It is merely that there is threat potential. Big difference there. But in the context of all of this, again, I could preach about it until I'm blue in the face. I think it's high time that we really treat this subject seriously. And yes, I agree with Christopher Mellon. I think it's long past time for Congress to discover the answers to some of these questions and share them with the public. And I completely agree. We need to take the subject seriously. Science needs to be applied to this. And I think there needs to be a greater degree of transparency. Maybe it is soft disclosure, but maybe not the kind we were all expecting. I don't think it's so much the government telling us what they already know. I think it's really more a case of, well, now they need to find out and share it with us. Okay, more when we return here on the Graylian Report. I'm Micah Hanks, and this is the Graylian Report, keeping you company as we do every Monday night from 6 to 8 p.m. East Coast time, worldwide around the globe via KGRARadio.com. I tell you, every week there is some interesting UFO news. UAP, I meant. Sorry. We've got to continue to sanitize this so that people will take the subject seriously, right? But for guys like Stanton Friedman, taking the subject seriously didn't rely on government telling people what they knew about it, or even government saying, hey, we don't know anything and we're going to take it seriously. Again, it was a lifelong pursuit, you know, spent at the National Archives, spent in the field, spent earning an education in nuclear physics so that he could understand propulsion systems, which these unusual aircraft might even be employing. You know, Stanton Friedman was a true icon in the field for all of those reasons. And also because of that, he was a inspiration, I think, to many of us. Now, I'll point out, and I'll probably point it out a few more times throughout the course of the program, that again, his interpretation, based on the evidence that he examined, led him to the extraterrestrial hypothesis. Stanton always seemed to kind of say, look, that's most likely, and that's how I frame the debate. And so he would often say things like, well, the aliens must think this, or the aliens, what if the aliens saw that or did this? Again, it was very much that ETH paradigm. for Stanton Friedman. And it's interesting, I think, after his years of work, to see the way that people are, again, maybe trying to sterilize the subject a little bit and to present it as a less crazy kind of an idea. Not that it's necessarily crazy that extraterrestrial life might exist, or that there may be unusual aircraft in our skies. Again, I think it's all in how you approach the subject. And so for him, on review of the evidence, this was simply a reality. But Stanton was a fascinating person, and again, I maintain that he was a true inspiration to so many of us, and I think the first time I probably ever spoke to him was actually way back in my days working in broadcast radio. And we'd had him booked as a guest on a program I was producing at that time. And I remember during the interview, we lost him at some point, and something really bizarre happened where he had been lost, and I tried to call him back, and he was already on the line. And I remember he says to me, "That was extremely weird." And we had a chuckle about it. A number of years later, I interviewed him for an essay that I published in an anthology. And then I also booked him on a radio program that I was hosting on a radio network prior to my work doing the Grayling Report. And that radio interview, in fact, we're going to feature on the program because I've kept it in my archives all these years. It's kind of funny because back then I was certainly not the skilled interviewer or radio host that I am today. Stanton, on the other hand, I would maintain, has always had that kind of friendly charm and a incredible amount of knowledge about the subject. And so as we get into that conversation a bit later, you know, you'll be able to see some of that, and you'll hear the way that Stanton, I mean, almost any subject that you bring up, he has a unique perspective on this. He truly was an expert, if ever there was one, on the UFO subject. But my fondest memories of being with Stan over the years, I finally got to meet him at a dinner one time, and he was there with Kathleen Martin, who had been one of his co-authors on several books, and they often did appearances together in public. But Stanton had to leave that evening because there'd been, I believe, actually a death in his family. And the next time I would run into him would be at the International UFO Congress. We didn't really get to spend a whole lot of time together on that occasion. But then there was an event that we were both booked at back in 2016 out in Big Bear Lake, California. And when I flew out there to California, it was such a funny experience because I left at the crack of dawn from Asheville. And by the time I get several time zones over, it's still morning when I touch down at LAX. And upon arrival, I was tasked with one job: find the famous nuclear physicist Stanton Friedman and get into a Dodge Charger and ride with him for several hours up into the mountains. Well, I found Stan and we jumped in the car, and boy, what a conversation. I mean, we were probably traveling together for a good 2.5-3 hours, and we stopped in Riverside, California for lunch too. And we talked about MJ-12. We talked about Philip J. Class. We talked about Alan Hendry and his UFO handbook. We talked about skepticism. We talked about belief. We talked about everything. And it was truly a cherished experience. I mean, being able to spend hours and hours talking with Stanton, traveling, you know, dining with him. And then we had dinner together that night once we actually got up in the mountains. But I mean, he was just a wonderful guy. And that's how he was. You know, I'd hear a little knock at the door and here he'd be coming over. He's like, "Hey, do you got dinner plans tonight?" You know, and so, "Well, yes, Stanton Friedman, I'd love to come have dinner with you." You know, and we're sitting in a restaurant there at the event that our friend Trevor Potter had put on in Big Bear Lake. And it looks an awful lot like Twin Peaks or something. You know, it's just a wonderful little town in general. But sitting there with Stanton and just having these discussions about, again, we talked also at length about the national security implications of UFO studies. And I think that was definitely something that he was interested in. And that was an approach that he thought was worthwhile. And we had that conversation well in advance of the kind of commentary that we're seeing about this subject in the here and now in the American press as it relates to defense, the U.S. Navy, the U.S. Air Force, etc. Stanton was well aware of all these things. And Stanton also, of course, had a background in nuclear physics and had actually worked on potential nuclear propulsion projects, and was convinced thereby that based on what he knew and what his actual work and experience involved, that these things weren't our own, that they weren't experimental U.S. aircraft using nuclear propulsion systems. Again, he said, "I worked on trying to build those kinds of propulsion systems. I know the ins and outs of that very well. And as a nuclear physicist, what I'm hearing about in these flying saucer reports don't seem to match." So that in addition to being the first civilian investigator on the scene, so to speak, with Roswell, even though the first book written about that subject was by Charles Berlitz and William Moore, again, Stanton Friedman had actually been investigating Roswell and had had some relationship to that book even before coming on the scene himself as a UFO investigator. But again, that background in nuclear physics probably was one of the portions that was so helpful for him. Now, one of the best stories that he ever told me about his time in UFO advocacy over the years had been when he went to the home of Carl Sagan for tea. Yes, he knew Carl Sagan. In fact, they'd been in the same graduating class at Chicago University. And so I'd asked him, I said, you know, Sagan seemed to have some interesting ideas on UFOs because although he was a skeptic, Sagan seemed to be, to me always, the good kind of skeptic that knew that you could attack an idea that you didn't have to attack an individual. Sagan was not a snarky little jerk who knew so little about the subject that he had to attack and ridicule people to get his point across. He was always a gentleman. And on that point, Stanton Friedman often argued against that. In fact, in a letter he wrote to the New York Times in response to something they published by Lawrence Krauss, he noted that, of course, Krauss had refused my challenge, that being Stan's, to a public debate. He said, as might be expected, he followed the four basic rules for UFO debunking. One, don't bother me with the facts, my mind is made up. Two, what the public doesn't know, I will not tell them. Three, if I can't attack the data, I will attack the people. It is easier. And four, I will do my research by proclamation since investigation is too difficult. Very fair points, because often people who are overtly, unnecessarily skeptical of this subject, they don't know anything about it. They don't know what they're arguing against, so they just attack people. That's intellectually dishonest, and it's lazy, but it is easier, and Stanton was well aware of that. And because of all this, I was fascinated with the idea that he had known Carl Sagan, because Sagan was a good skeptic who made logical arguments. And I said, Stan, when you met Carl, what did you guys talk about? He said, well, of course we talked about UFOs. And I said, what did he tell you? And when was the last time you talked to him? He says, well, we'd been in the same graduating class and we'd stayed friends and colleagues for years. And he said, I actually went to his home right before he died. And Ann Druffel had actually arranged for us to be able to have like coffee and cake before an event I was doing there in Boston. And Stan said that he and Sagan, when they were talking about UFOs, he basically appealed to Carl. He said, Carl, I know you know that there's something more to this subject. And here's what Stanton said that Sagan told him. He said, Stan, I agree. I definitely think that there is at least something to the subject. However, I have to be careful in how I present that to the public because this is how you lose funding. There are all kinds of problems that can result from me being too loosey-goosey in the way I handle the UFO subject publicly. Of course, sitting here in my living room, I can tell you I'm interested. I'm skeptical, but I'm interested. And I found that fascinating because here's Sagan sitting there in his living room with Stanton telling him, I mean, one of the greatest scientists of our day saying, yeah, Stan, I think you're right, and there's definitely something to it. But then seeming to convey to this very respected UFO researcher that part of his skepticism resulted from the way he felt he had to present himself on the subject publicly. Once again, stigmas. And none of this is to say that Sagan was being disingenuous or that he was lying about what he really thought when he wrote about this and spoke about it publicly. I think that really, especially if you read The Demon Haunted World, he raises some great skeptical arguments, and I do think that generally that was a good representation of Sagan's approach when it came to the subject. I would further note, if he were truly dismissive of the subject, he wouldn't have gone to the great lengths to write books that largely dealt with debunking UFOs. He tackled the subject from the perspective of being skeptical but arming himself with knowledge. And yes, at very least, based on his private communication with Stanton Friedman, as Stanton related to me, he said, yes, most definitely Sagan was interested in the subject. We talked about it at length, and I do think maybe that some of his interests were kept out of public view. And then one of the very last experiences I actually had with Stan. We were up there at the Esotericon event last year that Paul Kimball, his nephew, had put on, and we were all going to lunch, and my good pal Chris had been there, and he had a convertible Volkswagen Beetle. And figuring that Chris and I are just going to ride by ourselves, Stanton kind of jumps in and says, ah, do you mind if I ride with you guys? And then our friend Holly also said, yeah, I'm coming with you guys. So, of course, Stan gets shotgun in the convertible, and Holly and I are sitting in the back, and she snaps a selfie of she and I from the back seat with Stan in front and us all riding together in the beautiful Canadian weather on our way to lunch. And Holly even said the other day that was her favorite memory of Stan, definitely one of mine too. And I could go on telling you Stan's stories, but what I would rather do for this special commemorative edition of the podcast is to revisit an interview I did with him a number of years ago. This is the longest interview I ever did with Stan, not the only one, but definitely the longest. And we had booked this for the anniversary of the Pearl Harbor attacks. And I talked with Stanton about a number of cases that usually he was not asked about, including the Cash Landrum incident, the so-called Battle of Los Angeles, and later on we'll even get into some discussion with him about alleged disappearances associated with UFO sightings. So in this first segment, we opened the conversation talking about his background and experience with nuclear physics and how that applied to his research into UFOs. Without further ado, I give you, ladies and gentlemen, the late and truly great Stanton Friedman. Stanton, how are you?
I'm okay here in beautiful Fredericton, New Brunswick, Canada.
That's right. I know you stay busy, so let's go ahead and just find out a little bit about what you've been up to lately.
Well, you know, for 43 years, I've been lecturing all over the place about flying saucers, and this was no exception. So far, I've spoken in all 50 states, 9 Canadian provinces, and 16 other countries. Got 2 more countries coming up this winter. One of them will be warm anyway, Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, toward the end of January.
Oh, really?
Strange place to be speaking. They're having a conference about innovation, and there'll be a panel of 5 of us. One is Muslim, and I don't recognize his name at all, but Nick Pope will be there, and Michio Kaku, and Jacques Vallée, and me. And we will have, an hour and a half on a panel to sort out UFOs and innovation, which will be different anyway, and certainly it'll be warmer there than here.
I imagine it will.
A long way to go.
I'm waiting to see when they're going to start booking you for conferences elsewhere outside, not just the continental United States, but perhaps outside of Earth, maybe in outer space next.
Well, if we could arrange that, I'd be happy to be there. I mean, have PowerPoint, we'll travel. You know?
That's right. I'm sure it will. You know, you mentioned some nuclear excursions. I'm fascinated to know that you're still doing that. And how does that pertain to your research with ufology?
Well, one of the special things I bring to the subject is the fact that I spent 14 years in industry working on far-out advanced nuclear and space systems. This wasn't just little think tank sort of groups. I worked on nuclear rocket engines at Westinghouse. We tested nuclear rocket engines on the ground. We in Los Alamos and Aerojet General, this is back in the 60s, each tested nuclear rocket engines. And Los Alamos was the biggest one, less than 7 feet in diameter, power level 4,400 megawatts. That's twice the power of Grand Coulee Dam, to give you something to compare it to. This would make a good upper stage for a rocket. When I was working for General Electric, we were working on nuclear-powered airplanes, and the advantage would be that you could stay aloft for thousands of hours. You better change the crew, but, I mean, you don't need refueling for thousands of hours.
Right.
And I worked on a fusion propulsion system. Those were efficient, but at Aerojet General Nucleonics in California, under the direction of Dr. John Luce, who had headed the Oak Ridge National Laboratory nuclear fusion program, we did a good-sized study of fusion for deep space propulsion. And I need to get people to understand that when you go from chemical stuff, let's look at bombs. World War II, a big bomb was a 10-ton blockbuster. That's 10 tons of explosive, if you will. Took a big old B-29 to carry it, and it made pretty good mess on the ground. By the end of the war in 45, we exploded atomic bombs, which also were carried aloft by B-29s, and they released as much energy as, let's say, 15,000 tons of TNT. Which is kind of a big jump. And in 1952, we tested our first H-bomb. That's a nuclear fusion device. And I wish I could have seen it. The fireball was 3 miles wide.
Can you imagine?
In the Pacific.
Yeah.
Yeah. Can you imagine what the aliens thought about that?
Oh, gosh.
The amount of energy released was only the equivalent of 10 million tons of TNT. Now, I go through this because I find that most people, they've heard megatons, kilotons, but they don't have something to compare them to. But you begin to see that there's kind of an advantage in going nuclear in terms of energy per unit weight. And incidentally, the Russians tested one that was 57 million tons of TNT equivalent. That's a real big bang. Now, the point of bringing this up is that you can use fusion reactions for deep space propulsion. If you're smart and use the right stuff in the right way and kick particles out the back end, 10 million times as much energy per particle as you can get in the dumb old chemical rocket. I mention all of this because one of the big objections to flying saucers, of course, is you can't get here from there.
Right.
The guys who talk about this only seem to think that we use chemical rockets.
Sure.
You know, Saturn V, V2s, etc. And there's just no comparison. An advantage of 10 million times as much energy per particle is rather substantial. And so, yeah, those programs were exciting. The data was classified. The work was interesting. And the programs got canceled, of course.
How does that add up, right?
Well, you know, and these were not small programs. The nuclear airplane program, we spent $100 million in 1958 at GE. And I mention that again because I've had several people try to imply that, hey, the only place research gets done is academia. And if Roswell happened, they would have had to pull all the scientists out of academia to study that. And I said, that's not true. We already had a huge number of large scientific and engineering research and development facilities. Some left over from atom bombs, which we kept testing and improving, if you will. But other ones, too, and in industry and places like Los Alamos and Hanford Works and Oak Ridge National Laboratory and, you know, Lockheed and GE and Westinghouse and all these other places. Who needed academia? And as I said to one guy who, after interviewing me, raised this argument, he said, don't you think all half the scientists would have been involved in Roswell if it had happened? Big if there, you see.
Mm-hmm.
I said, no, those who can't teach. And that set him back a little bit. See, I don't have a PhD. You don't need a pile higher and deeper degree to work in industry. Mm-hmm. You need smarts, and you want to work hard, and you don't need to be enamored of publish or perish the way the academics do.
Mm-hmm.
So the point is now that there's a point of intersection between this and UFOs. Every advanced civilization, and I think there's loads of them out there because of some new developments, which we'll go into in a minute,
oh, good.
Will figure out that their stars work by nuclear fusion and that you can use fusion if you do appropriate things to travel. I mean, you realize that neutron wasn't discovered until 1932. I mean, it was there all along, but we didn't know about it.
Right.
And yet, first nuclear fission in 38, first chain reaction in 42, December 2nd, 1942, at my alma mater, University of Chicago, on a squash court. That's where everybody does things. Well, it was an underground area and plenty of room to do secret work, and they built the first nuclear pile there. So things worked very quickly to that point. And, you know, I've also found that people have heard words like nuclear submarines, but they don't fully appreciate that there have been hundreds of them built, not just by the U.S., but by England and the Russians and the Chinese and French. So we're not talking about this one little old submarine. Sure, the Nautilus was 1956. Admiral Rickover, one of my heroes. But the startling fact to most people I found recently is that we have nuclear-powered aircraft carriers. Several countries have them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, look, these are huge, you know, about a quarter mile long, that kind of thing. And we nuclear-powered ones can operate at full speed continuously, and they can operate for 18 years without refueling.
It's a fair point he raises, and of course with his background in nuclear physics and how that applied to his UFO research, Stan was the perfect guy to talk about all this, although UFOs will be the subject when we return. I also mentioned we were going to get into a little discussion of WikiLeaks with him. This is definitely one of the most unique interviews with Stanton Friedman that you will ever hear on this commemorative edition celebrating his life and work. I am Micah Hankson. It is the Graylian Report. We'll be back after this. I'm Micah Hanks, and this is the Graylian Report, remembering the life and the work of UFO pioneer Stanton Friedman. And, of course, we're featuring segments from an interview that I did with him almost a decade ago on the anniversary of the Pearl Harbor attacks. Truly one of the best guys, I think, that you ever could have hoped to meet. He was always friendly. He never met a stranger and was always more than willing to talk about UFOs. And he spent a good amount of time on the microphone with me on this evening in question. So we return to that audio, traveling back in time to a long-lost conversation with Stanton Friedman, which I actually never aired for a number of years. I'm not sure why. You know, I did it for a live radio show, had a recording of it, never used it. And some time ago, it was featured for Graylian X subscribers. But gosh, you know, with Stan's passing, how better to remember him than an actual conversation with the man himself. And in this next portion, I get into not only top secret files and some of his work with the National Archives and going and searching for information about UFOs there, but we also talked about WikiLeaks, which has become, of course, big news only in recent weeks. Julian Assange, of course, after being holed up in the Ecuadorian embassy there in London for years. So it's interesting to go back in time, too, and get Stanton Friedman's perspectives on Assange, WikiLeaks, and how that relates to UFOs.
I was sent an email by a listener, and with all this talk of nuclear technology and how that applies to government aircraft and potential UFO sightings, they asked me to mention to you the Cash Landrum case from Texas in the 1980s and your thoughts on that.
Well, it was a good case. There's a whole book about it by John Schussler, who was international director of MUFON for several years, an aerospace engineer, worked for McDonnell Douglas in Houston, and this took place just outside Houston. Betty Cash and her friend, last name Landrum, and the nephew, a grandson, I guess, of one of the people, were out in I won't say in the middle of nowhere, but they were out away from Houston, and they saw this thing in the sky, sitting there, bright, a lot of light coming from it. It was evening, came close, they got out of the car, and there were a lot of physical effects. The car started to heat up, and they started to heat up, and they got sick. This went on for some time, and this thing came a lot closer to them. I'd call it a UFO, because I don't know what else to call it. And then there were a bunch of helicopters that came along and chased this thing. And many people have suggested the thing finally went over the Gulf in that direction. And I've talked to John about this, and many people have asked me, hey, Stan, was that one of those nuclear-powered airplanes that you worked on? Well, ours would certainly have been a conventional jet-powered plane, which you certainly would have heard. They didn't hear anything. I say probably not. Not that I'm saying I knew everything the government was doing. The program was not a black program, ours anyway. That is to say, the sign on the door said General Electric Aircraft Nuclear Propulsion Department. But the effects on the people, the data was classified, that we measurements we made. 3,500 people working on the program, 1,100 of them engineers and scientists. So there were a lot of classified technical reports. I was working on radiation shielding, which is kind of a problem because you do want to protect the pilot and anybody else around.
Sure.
And these are fairly high-powered reactors, much more so than the submarine reactors I mentioned earlier. Anyway, they came down, they got sick. And all the symptoms seem to point to radiation poisoning, as it's called. That is, you lose your hair, you have other problems. They didn't, one of them, both of the women are dead now, I guess. Classic symptoms of radiation exposure.
This, of course, all took place near an Air Force base. The conventional explanation was that people believe that this thing was some sort of a test craft that the U.S. military had been working with. So you think that it's unlikely that that is
the case? I think it's unlikely. I frankly do. No sign that there were neutrons involved, and that would make radioactivity, and certainly our aircraft nuclear propulsion systems had a lot of neutrons coming out.
Hmm.
Also, the absence of sound. We had a standard jet engine propulsion system. The way nuclear-powered airplanes work, you'd have a nuclear reactor which is producing heat, and you run air through it from the compressor on the jet engine. that warms the air a bit. You, in effect, you pump it through the reactor. It comes out at like 1,800 degrees going through the turbine, and off you go. Now, that turbine is noisy. It's a jet engine. That's what a jet engine is. Now, there's another approach where instead of cooling the reactor with air, you cool it with liquid metal, say a sodium-potassium alloy, which can carry away a lot more heat than air can per unit weight. And you can make a smaller reactor. The trouble is the stuff is very reactive, and you start fires when it's in touch with water. So if you make a smaller reactor, the coolant becomes radioactive. Pratt Whitney was working on a system like that, whereas we at General Electric had the direct cycle, the air-cooled system. In both cases, they had to have a, Pratt Whitney had a heat exchanger to take the heat from the reactor and run air by it in a special heat exchanger, and still put the air through a turbine, a jet engine. So you're still going to have noisy engines. And yeah, there are other ways you can make reactors. You can make compact systems and operate some kind of an electrical propulsion system. The Russians used 35 was the last number I had, compact reactors on their spacecraft. They would only produce a megawatt or a few hundred kilowatts, whereas to run an airplane, you need hundreds of megawatts. That's a lot of energy. A submarine might be, take 50 megawatts. Airplane takes a lot of oomph because you're going faster and so forth.
Absolutely.
And so I don't find much reason to believe that that was ours. There are all kinds of schemes, you know, for using nuclear energy. There's even gaseous core reactors for rockets. But whatever it was, they did suffer radiation damage. And John's point was that apparently we picked it up on radar or whatever, and these were our secret helicopters chasing it, and it was impossible to get information from the government. Who, us? No, we didn't have any helicopters out there.
Of course not.
I hope it doesn't surprise people that occasionally the government might lie about classified stuff.
Oh, no, certainly not. And, you know, that's something that we've been talking about a lot. And I don't want to change gears completely here, because I want to come back to what you just said about liquid metal used in cooling these devices. But first, let me jump in there while you mentioned secrecy there. This whole circumstance with WikiLeaks and Julian Assange, have you followed this any, Stanton?
Yeah.
Of course, then
yes, I have. And, you know, it's kind of got a couple of sides to it. An English debunker, and there are several English UFO debunkers, whose primary role is, don't bother me with the facts, my mind's made up. One guy said in a posting on UFO updates, I hope everybody noticed that despite all this top secret material being released, there was nothing about UFOs. So a bunch of us jumped in. The New York Times had some numbers. There was no top secret material. There were like 250,000-300,000 documents, but only 5% were even secret.
Right.
So the UFO stuff was top secret code word. Now, how do I know that? People say, you're just making an assumption. No, I'm not. When we went after the NSA, National Security Agency, or no such agency, that's the inside joke, you know.
Sure.
They're the big guys on the block. They listen to everybody else's communications and all that sort of stuff. Anyway, when the NSA finally got around to releasing 160 UFO documents, we found out about them in 1980. They released none. The justification for withholding them to a federal court judge was 80% blacked out originally. And when they finally, 16, 17, 18 years later, released the 160 NSA UFO documents, you could read one sentence per page. Everything else was whited out. And I'm told that was because I had shown the blacked out justification on television, and the NSA didn't like that because I didn't say, oh, that's because of sources and methods information. Of course, I did say that. But the point is, you could, when they finally released these 160 documents, you could see that the classification at the top was top secret umbra. So you've got confidential, and you've got restricted, you've got confidential, you've got secret, you've got top secret code word. And there was nothing on the WikiLeaks pile that was above secret.
Very interesting.
Yet we know, yeah, and the New York Times gave some numbers. There were about 5% that were secret, but nothing above that, no top secret. So you wouldn't expect anything to appear. And remember, the reason for the problem here is that after 9/11, the intelligence agencies were given a hard time by other people in government to say, you guys never share information. So even though these guys over here had something, if that had been combined with what you guys over there had, we would have known what was going on and could have edited it. You guys got to share your information. So what they did was set up this specialized computerized network, you know, basically the internet, to which literally, I've heard numbers from 800,000 to 3 million, pick a number, it doesn't matter really, the point's the same.
Sure.
People would have access, all they'd need would be a secret clearance. And they could have access to all this shared information. Remember, the guy who got this stuff was a private. Which is tells you something.
Yeah, certainly does. Certainly does.
Bad system is what it tells you. But there was no top secret stuff there. And not only did the NSA, quote, release, unquote, top secret stuff, one sentence per page, which is funny when you look at it, the CIA also, after a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit, they released 700 pages, nothing above secret. They mentioned that there was other material. We went after that, and after 5 years, I got a bunch of top secret CIA UFO documents. The only trouble was they were all blacked out except maybe 8 words on a page.
How convenient.
And it was, yeah, one page, which I really admire, it said, deny in toto at the top. They couldn't find 8 words on that page.
They couldn't find one word.
So what I'm saying is, when we find the few that we did get, it was clear it was top secret code word. So nobody in his right mind would expect, unless he knew nothing about security, which this Englishman obviously didn't, would expect that there would be access to really highly classified material. There was a letter, famous letter from General Twining, September 1947, a report to another general talking about UFOs and they're real and not imaginary and they move fast and a whole bunch of other things. This was only a secret document and could not possibly have talked about what was recovered at Roswell.
I think I said earlier that we didn't talk about Roswell. Obviously, a little bit slipped in, and that must have slipped my mind. But hey, that was one of the cases he was best known for. Fond memories indeed of Stanton Friedman, the late and truly great UFO icon. And we will continue this conversation with him in the next hour. I am Micah Hanks. It is the Graylian Report, remembering the life of Stanton Friedman, when we return right after this.
Science, space and the cosmos, exploring our past, our future, and the mysteries of our universe. Taking a critical look at reality and a journey to the edges of human understanding. The future is now. This is the Graylian Report with Micah Hanks.
Welcome back. It is the second hour of this week's edition of the program, continuing our tribute to one of the true greats. As far as UFO studies go, Stanton Friedman. And we've got a lot more of that conversation. Going back in time, talking with Stan. Again, I think surreal is the word for that. As we revisit this wonderful conversation. And, of course, a lot of fond memories about a truly wonderful individual and a very talented researcher and scientist. I do want to remind you, of course, as always, if you like this program and you would like to support our work and what we do, you can head right on over to GraylianReport.com/X. And that's where you can sign up, become a member today. It's only $77 a year or $7 a month, but the annual package gets you 1 month free annually, so that's kind of nice, and that gets you the additional edition, the Graylian X podcast, every week. And here in the next few days, we will be dropping an all-new episode of Graylian Enigmas, the monthly special. And, you know, we've got some other good surprises that will be forthcoming. I'll be saving the official announcement for some additional programming for a later time. But always like to drop hints when I can. So, you know, one of the things that's fascinating about Stanton is we are getting our minds back into gear for this conversation. And even with the loss of someone as great as Stanton Friedman and his lifetime of achievements and everything, listening back to this audio, I'm reminded of one thing fundamentally. How chipper he was, how bright, how positive. He was always friendly. Usually when I would call him at his home in New Brunswick, and he would pick up, "How you doing, Stan?" You know, we'd just kind of shoot the breeze for a minute when he would pick up the phone, and he would always respond the same way. "I'm great, of course." He was always so bright, always so positive. You know, over the years, he, like many people who study this subject, he was a recipient of challenges from skeptics, most notably Philip J. Klass, and who later in this interview, you're going to hear him actually touch on Philip J. Klass and a famous instance where he was actually given a check by Philip J. Klass because Stanton won a bet. And that famous check that was sent to him by Philip J. Klass, he framed it, but then that was actually included in Stanton's book, Flying Saucers and Science. So if you have that book, there's a photo of that check in the book. Or if we wanted to go all Big Trouble in Little China, we could say, like Jack Burton did, "The check's in the mail." But to his credit, that's exactly what Philip J. Klass did. He actually did send Stanton the check that he promised. He did follow through with his promise when he lost the bet. But that was the kind of guy Stanton was. He was willing to engage skeptics openly, and he always took in good humor their arguments against him. Which is interesting because as my own skepticism towards certain aspects of UFO studies has deepened, you know, a lot of people can't get their head wrapped around the idea of you can be skeptical sometimes, and you can also endorse an idea at others. And even though we're going to talk about MJ-12, which I think is pretty thoroughly debunked, that is a subject that Stanton put a lot of time, effort, and energy into. And when he and I met for lunch, back in, I guess, early 2016 in Riverside, California, I'd asked him about that, and he said obviously a lot of the documents that we associate with MJ-12 were completely fabricated. That's true, and I've never said that that wasn't the case, but what I also feel is that there is some good information in that batch of files as well. Now, many people differed with Stanton on that. A lot of UFO researchers said this has been roundly debunked, we don't want to hear about MJ-12 anymore. But I would argue, with full knowledge of the fact that they are largely considered to be a hoax, and I actually agree with that determination, I would nonetheless contend that you're not going to know if something is a hoax unless you conduct responsible historic or scientific research in order to determine that. And so for those who had been critical of Stanton Friedman spending so much time over the years on MJ-12, you know, agree with him or not about the merit of some of the information contained therein. But you have to commend somebody for going to the trouble of doing the investigation that Stanton did in order to determine what was true and what was not. But one of the most interesting things in his book, Top Secret Magic, that I noticed was the fact that, according to Stanton Friedman, Donald Menzel, who had been a very well-known skeptical astronomer and one of the first really prominent skeptics to write about the UFO subject, I have his book, and it's a very good book. Menzel apparently had a secret clearance, and according to the MJ-12 documents, Menzel was also allegedly part of the so-called MJ-12. And what's interesting is that no one, to my knowledge, apart from Stanton Friedman, nobody really talks about the fact that Donald Menzel, while being a UFO debunker, had a very low-profile government clearance of some kind. And by low-profile, I mean he never talked about it much. Nobody ever talks about that. There's very little attention paid to that. Now, why is that significant? And actually, I'll tell you this, too. The very document from the National Archives that Stanton found, which indicated this, was a correspondence between Menzel and, before he became president, John F. Kennedy, when he was on the board of advisors at Harvard, I believe. And he was asking Menzel about something, and Menzel said, "You know, I wish I could give you more information about that, but you don't have the necessary clearance." So why is all that significant? Well, of course, and make of MJ-12 what you will, I always caution people, knowing, of course, that there's some really bad information that was released, and this intentionally to confuse, mislead, and thereby also compromise the UFO community so that UFO researchers could be made out to look like a bunch of dimwits. Again, this information was obviously intended to do just that. So again, make of it what you will on that front, but the papers nonetheless insinuate that Donald Menzel had been involved in some top secret study groups, MJ-12 no less, that were looking into UFOs. Interesting that indeed he did actually have a secret clearance and might have qualified for such secret work at that time. But again, you'll find nothing else about that anywhere apart from Stanton Friedman in the historical detective work that he did at the National Archives. And so while I don't think that he completely vindicated MJ-12, the process of historical inquiry that went into an attempt at validating them or doing exactly the opposite and proving them to be hoaxes, I think that the historical work nonetheless provided some interesting insights into key players in the UFO mystery, especially in those early years. And that to me is very interesting. So again, even if the end result ends up being that, well, something like MJ-12 is a hoax, you've got to do good research in order to make that determination. And that's part of the problem, I think, with these sorts of subjects. All too often, people see something that seems unlikely, and then they just go, well, there's nothing to this. And that's why I penned an article at Mysterious Universe recently entitled, "Is Unwarranted UFO Skepticism Actually in Conflict with National Security?" And on a slightly humorous side note, at least one skeptic on his blog took issue with it and thought that it's naive of people to put faith in the U.S. Navy and the military in general if they are saying that they want to examine unusual aircraft that are seen in our skies. I'm thinking to myself, thank you for proving my point. Because again, some people are so skeptical that they don't even put any faith in government looking into these issues. To which I would simply say, do you feel more comfortable with the idea of the possibility that China or Russia or some other nation is just flying aircraft or drones or something into our airspace? I mean, would you be comfortable with that? I mean, folks at home, ask yourself, when we talk about unidentified flying objects, they could be any number of things, but all too often there is the logical fallacy, you might say, a misinterpretation that, well, people who are interested in UFOs must think that they are all one thing and probably aliens. I know Stanton was in that camp. That was his opinion. My opinion is that we should probably reserve judgment. We may be dealing with any number of things, but especially if these are something that originate from right here on Earth and they belong to an enemy nation, I want my government looking at that. And hence why I make that differentiation between unwarranted skepticism, where people simply choose not to believe without really reviewing the evidence, versus a very healthy kind of skepticism that I actually espouse on this program. You need to be skeptical. And so for Stanton Friedman, he had a specific phrase that he liked to use, one of his many famous witticisms, you might say, and that was, "Don't bother me with the facts, my mind is already made up." And so with people like Stanton Friedman doing the kind of diligent historical research that he did, I would maintain that whether or not the ultimate end result is the validation of something like MJ-12 or even convincing skeptics of a UFO reality, nonetheless, what you find along the way is some valuable resource material. And Stanton Friedman over the years contributed so much valuable resource material to the public as a result of his UFO inquiries. And again, at the end of the day, I think that led him to the determination that there is nothing else we can use for a model of interpretation here but alien visitors, extraterrestrials. These are aliens, and they have been visiting us, and they've been keeping tabs on us at least since around the end of the Second World War. That was Stanton's entire contention. You know, again, I would have to see more evidence before I could say that is what this phenomena represents. In other words, I think there are still an awful lot of unanswered questions about this. So I want to get back to this audio with him. And in this next audio soundbite on that subject of going to the National Archives and doing research and trying to find information and memorandums that talk about UFOs and also government UFO studies like Project Blue Book, we got into that aspect of the conversation here. And part of what's so fascinating is actually hearing Stanton talk about the process of going to the archives, requesting folders and boxes, and looking through documents and what that process actually entails. And so we won't waste any time. We will get right back to the audio with our featured interview with the late, great Stanton Friedman.
With regard to the WikiLeaks thing, though, that not to divert here, but do you think, let me just ask you this, do you think that Julian Assange is bluffing when he makes these assertions that the cables that will be released in this so-called Pandora file that he's talked about, if any bodily harm comes to him or his organization, do you think he's bluffing, or do you think that there's actually anything of substance considering the track record with the release of documents?
I don't know. I don't think he has anything in there, but he's mentioned that there will be some documents that do mention UFOs. He didn't say they're top secret, though. Mm-hmm. Not at all. And we have no reason to think they were, because this guy, this private, apparently didn't have access to top secret documents.
Yeah, and I'm surprised he had access to anything.
It just doesn't add up. Now, In other words, absence of evidence is not evidence for absence. Just because he didn't release any top secret hot, you know, here's the analysis of the record from Roswell kind of documents, doesn't mean they don't exist.
Mm-hmm.
It means there'd be no good reason to expect that they would be in this pile because it's the wrong pile. It doesn't have high enough security
right.
markings on it. And so many people have no idea how huge the government holdings of classified documents. The Eisenhower Library, for example, remember he went out of office in 1961, so we're talking about almost 50 years now. They have about 250,000, it changes because they do some declassification, 250,000 pages of classified material in their National Security Council files alone. Still classified. They've released a lot of stuff, but declassified it. But that's just the one library. If you go to the National Archives in College Park, Maryland, used to be in downtown Washington, they have a record group 341, which has loads of stuff in it. The equivalent, it's 9,800 feet of shelf space on files.
Wow.
That's the equivalent of about 1,000 four-drawer filing cabinets.
Yeah, that's pretty big.
These are, Air Force headquarters files from roughly 1948. The Air Force didn't come into being until late 47, through about 1956. And so nobody's looked at all that stuff, and at least 5% of that is top secret, because the finder's aid, which I have, which in itself is 57 pages or so long, lists, it gives titles for each section. Top secret correspondence between headquarters and other installations might be 1,000 feet of material that was secret, and maybe 50 feet of material that was top secret. So you have all that information, but there's no way to go look at that stuff. You can ask them to bring you certain boxes. And sometimes they'll bring you boxes which have sheets in them, withdrawal sheets, they're called.
Mm-hmm.
And these replace the classified documents. So it might say withdrawal sheet, 2 pages, John Smith letter to Joe Jones, and give you a date and top secret. Now, you can make a request for review of that, classification review, mandatory classification review, it's called. And these used to take, maybe they've sped them up now, I don't know, a year to 6 years to get a response to. And I've gotten some interesting material that way. I mean, you don't know what's in them, and you're not looking at them and say, oh, I'd like a copy of this. You don't have access.
So you're kind of shooting in the dark when you're doing that, right?
Yeah, now I got lucky. I saw one that was a certain date from two people I was interested in, and this related to one of the MJ-12 documents. So I said, let's see if we can get that. And it took 2 years for me to get that. And indeed, it was very useful to me to have that. When I finally got it, it was declassified. Nothing fancy in it, just proving that these two guys were in touch at that time. And which somebody, some other document had said they were, but this was confirmation of that. But it only took 2 years to get it. I mean, 6 years is a bit long. You have to say, what did I ask for?
Oh, yeah, I hear it takes some time, huh?
Well, there's not only these NSA and CIA documents. They're the most obvious ones, proving that there is a cover-up. When people ask me, aren't you frustrated by just blacked out and whited out and stuff? I said, well, sure, I'd like to know what's underneath that, but it proves they're covering up. But there's much more extensive proof than that. For example, in 1969, after the Condon Report came out in January of that year, this is a 965-page book, basically saying, oh, there's nothing in UFOs. They don't tell you in the summary that 30% of the cases they looked at couldn't be explained. But anyway, once that came out, and they only spent $539,000, but once that came out, which recommended that Project Blue Book, ostensibly the only Air Force group concerned with UFOs, be closed. an Air Force general who worked on a space program, Carol Bolander, he worked on the Lunar Excursion Module. We landed on the moon in July of 69. So after that, his first assignment was, what should we do about Project Blue Book? Now, he had no previous involvement with it. He was busy working 12-hour days, he told me when I located him more than 10 years later. Anyway, he was asked, what should we do about Blue Book? And he wrote a memo, which we didn't get to years later, which resulted in the closure of Project Blue Book. In the memo, he says, moreover, reports of UFOs which could affect national security are made in accordance with Joint Army-Navy Air Force Publication 146 or Air Force Manual 55-11 and are not part of the Blue Book system.
What?
That's what he said. Now, two paragraphs later, as if to reinforce that, he said, if we close Project Blue Book, the public won't have a place to report UFO sightings. However, as previously noted, reports which could affect national security will continue to be investigated using the procedures established for that purpose. Now, that's a shocking statement. I managed to locate him. He was alive then. He isn't now, incidentally. Mm-hmm. And talked to him. I said, it sounds to me like you're saying there were two separate paths for reporting stuff. If it could affect national security, it went over here. If it didn't, it would go to Project Blue Book. He said, that's right. And the example we talked about briefly was if a saucer went down the runway at an Air Force base where nuclear weapons were stored, that's a national security problem.
And that's happened.
If you and I are, you know, standing out in the street here and watching the UFO fly over, big deal. People see them all the time. So what this means is that since the closure of Project Blue Book in 1969, December, the Air Force has been lying consistently, saying, we don't investigate UFOs anymore. And we didn't see any sign, and no report evaluated, investigated by the Air Force gives any evidence of being a threat to the security of the United States. That's right. They didn't get the ones which are related to national security.
Interesting.
And, you know, 40 years they've been lying about this. To give you another example, biggest study ever done for the United States Air Force, unclassified study. I don't know about the classified ones because I haven't seen them. I can have some ideas. But anyway, was Project Blue Book Special Report 14. Data on 3,201 sightings. That's a lot of cases. The work was done by professionals at Battelle Memorial Institute in Columbus, Ohio, not far from the what was then the Air Technical Intelligence Center and where Project Blue Book was in Dayton. Wright-Patterson Air Force Base is just a hop, skip, and a jump over to Columbus. And Battelle Memorial Institute there had a contract to look at all the sightings in the files from 48 through 52, I guess. They put out this report. Well, put out is not quite right. They completed, prepared a report, Project Blue Book Special Report Number 14, which was not distributed. There was no Freedom of Information Act at that time, of course. Instead, they put out a very widely distributed press release, October 1955. And they had a picture of a round vehicle, and the thrust of the press release was, we'll soon be building things that look like this. Don't worry about it. It's ours.
Hmm.
In the press release, the Secretary of the Air Force, Donald Quarles, said, quote, on the basis of this report, we believe that no objects such as those properly described as flying saucers have overflown the United States. Even the unknown 3% could have been identified as conventional phenomena or illusions if more complete information had been obtained.
Illusions.
Now, that sounds pretty straightforward.
Yeah.
The only trouble is it's a total lie. I read that. I had found a copy of this, a privately published version, at the University of California, Berkeley Library, about 1961 or so. And the guy included this press release, a guy named Dr. Leon Davidson, who had been working at Los Alamos, which has a huge collection of UFO material, incidentally. I've been there in the library, lots of UFO stuff. If you look at the report itself, which of course I did, there are charts, 240 charts, tables, graphs, and maps. I'll admit I was in data heaven.
I bet you were.
No place else would you find this kind of information.
Right.
And it turns out, and I had to collect it from different charts and tables because they didn't make it easy for you, it was not a classified report, surprisingly. And in it you find that of the 3,201 sighting reports, all of 21.5% were listed as unknowns. They said 3%. Now, I don't care how you slice it, 21.5% is not a rounding off of 3. You know, no way, Jose.
Right.
In addition, they had a separate category. Every sighting was placed in one of about 6 categories: aircraft, balloon, astronomical, miscellaneous, psychological aberrations, a nice way of saying crackpot cases. 1.5% that was.
Yeah.
And insufficient information and unknowns. Well, 9.3% were listed as insufficient information. So the Secretary of the Air Force, mind you, was lying big time about both parts of what he said. The sightings weren't 3%, the unknowns, they were 21.5%, and they, by definition in the report, were not the ones for which there was insufficient information.
That is incredible.
They did a quality evaluation of all these sightings. Hmm. And they had a rule. For example, no sighting could be listed as an unknown, they're the only ones you're interested in, unless all 4 of the final report evaluators agreed it was an unknown. It would only take 2 to make it anything else.
Hmm.
So they were pretty persnickety. They did a quality evaluation of all the sightings. The better the quality, the more likely to be listed as an unknown. The opposite of what the skeptics try to tell you, in other words.
Hmm.
And so this was, I'll call it lying, a misrepresentation, you call it whatever you want, but there's no question that the public has been misled, that the media has not done its job of digging into the facts, the data, the press release that I mentioned, appeared all over the country, October 23rd, 4th, 5th, sometime in there, 1955. And most papers carry, it was an official Air Force press release, after mm-hmm. all. And I've included in a copy that you can get from me, no copyright on a government report, you know.
Oh, and yeah.
For those people who like tables and charts. And one of the interesting things here is that nowhere in the press release does it give the title of the report. Surely if a reporter had seen Project Blue Book, Special Report Number 14, he would have said, "What happened to 1 through 13? We haven't heard anything about them."
Yeah, I know.
And had the truth been told, it would have been, they're all classified.
I remember out in California at an event, Stanton had a copy of that file that he's talking about, the special report, and he was turning through it and showing me key elements in the pages. And again, just he was a trove of knowledge and someone who was always excited to talk with people, willing to converse with folks and engage. He was always sitting at his table at events. And yes, of course, he was selling books, but many people would just wander by. They'd want their picture taken with him. They would want to talk to him. And it didn't matter to Stanton Friedman who you were, what your interest was. He was always willing to talk with people. He was always willing to share his knowledge and what information that he had about these subjects. And I think that that's truly inspiring. He was a great conversationalist and, if anything, an educator. Okay, when we come back, I want to get into a section here with him where he's talking about the Battle of Los Angeles. I've had mixed feelings about this case over the years, but Stanton gives us some very interesting insights into that. We'll have that and much more on this commemorative conversation with the late, great Stanton Friedman when we return right here on the Graylian Report. Welcome back. It is the Graylian Report, continuing a conversation from some time ago with Stanton Friedman. And I tell you, he was indeed a very interesting person to talk with about the subject of UFOs. Spent truly a life researching this subject and was arguably one of the most well-known, one of the most visible researchers ever to look at that subject. It was featured in documentary television programs, films, a number of books. I interviewed him both on the radio and also for print publications over the years. We got to know each other pretty well and even traveled to some events together and things like that and had some wonderful experiences. And so again, I'm eager to get back into this conversation with Stanton. During this portion, we will be talking with him about the Battle of Los Angeles, keeping in mind that this recording was made on the anniversary of Pearl Harbor, and so some of these historic events from wartime were on our mind. And so, without further ado, Stanton Friedman on the Battle of Los Angeles.
Stanton, we talked about a lot of secret aircraft and a lot of government intervention and secrets that have been taking place over the years. There's something that's been on my mind, and I wanted to pick your brain about it. This so-called Battle of Los Angeles, it being today the anniversary of the attack on Pearl Harbor, this incident took place only 3 months after the fact. What do you know about the Battle of Los Angeles?
Well, I've read quite a bit about it, and people have collected the newspaper articles. There were comments made by General George Marshall and so forth. Certainly there was something up there, and they were firing the guns protecting Los Angeles at it and supposedly hit it, but nothing happened. And the whole thought was maybe it's the Japanese who breached our defenses, and why they would fly something over Los Angeles, who knows? Could it have been alien? Of course it could have, but again, who knows? And so you'll hear many different interpretations. There were some of the original witnesses have been interviewed, but there's a movie coming out, and they wanted me out there for that.
Oh, really?
To be on a panel that was going to be out and promote and stuff. It's an interesting event. I lived on the other coast during World War II in New Jersey, and the little town I lived in had access for big ships coming in from the ocean, so there were loads of chemical plants around there. And we were very worried about German submarines shelling big oil refineries. And as a matter of fact, in Linden, which is 18 miles from New York City, toward Philadelphia, they made better 90% of the high-octane fuel used during World War II. So there was great concern about sneak attacks from somebody offshore and starting a fire there, and boy, that would have been a beauty.
Oh, yeah.
So what I'm saying is it was not unrealistic for people on the coast to be concerned about enemies approaching. The Japanese had a great navy. We were not yet in good shape at that time. A big chunk of our Navy got destroyed at Pearl Harbor. Today's the anniversary, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And so something happened. We don't know what it was. And when you're in that kind of situation, you'll get all kinds of people telling you all kinds of things. And, you know, great for science fiction plots about what was really going on. And I don't know that we'll ever know. There have been some government documents, and there's some legitimacy about the event. And as a matter of fact, I believe a couple of people got killed on the ground from shells that came down.
I'd heard that, yeah.
Because they fired hundreds of these shells. So there was great concern. What I'm trying to say is some people would say, well, what were they worried about? Well, you know, Fortress America we think about now, but in 1942... there was a great deal of concern about what was going to happen. And the Germans were sinking ships all over the Atlantic. The Japanese were sinking them in the Pacific. There were honest and legitimate concerns. And after the war, incidentally, it was found that there were some events close to New Jersey that were kept secret. The Germans got a lot closer than people had thought.
Hmm.
Well, you know, for public peace and stuff, we had air raid wardens, we had blackouts, your lights on your car were covered the top half with black paint.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't games. And when the air raid wardens came by, when there was an alert, you better shut off all the lights or have heavy drapes or whatever. If there's any lights showing, the air raid wardens who walked around with a helmet and a flashlight would stop by, and you were in trouble. What I'm saying is, this wasn't game playing. This was serious business. And many Americans don't realize how close the war was.
Mm-hmm.
If we hadn't broken, there's a good example of secrecy. Mm-hmm. We'd broken the German codes, the Enigma codes.
Oh, yes.
And there were 12,000 people in Bletchley Park in England who listened to the German military communications. Now, that wasn't that difficult, but they were encoded. And they decoded them and translated them and were very careful about who that information went to, because we couldn't allow the Germans to find out that we had broken the code, because then they'd stop using it, they'd change it, and we'd be in deep trouble. But it is very nice to know where the other guy is sending his fighter planes, how many troops he's sending where. We'd also broken the Japanese codes. Now, you'd think when the war was over, there would have been an announcement. Hey, look how great we are. It took 25 years after World War II for there to be any mention that we had broken the German codes or the Japanese codes. And one of the reasons, incidentally, was other people were using the same coding machines, and we were listening to their conversations, too. So, can you keep secrets? 12,000 people kept their mouths shut for
somehow
25 years after the war was over.
Rather miraculously, too, I might add. Well, you know, that said, and I've actually chased some of these down. I have to point something else out here, too. I'd seen on a number of blogs this reference to the craft that was witnessed during the so-called Battle of Los Angeles resembling a giant butterfly. When I ended up using Ancestry.com and got the Reno Evening Gazette from the following day, and it didn't make any mention. That was the newspaper that was attributed to that remark. There were consistencies, however, between that and what the LA Times had said with regard to the length of fire. As I understand it, this was a large, slow-moving object that allegedly had appeared, and that they had fired on this thing off and on for about 2 hours. Now, if there was a craft, what in the heck can sustain that kind of artillery fire for that period?
I don't know. Who knows? I mean, it's truly a mysterious event. And if we could look at the alien archives, maybe we could find out what somebody's adventure was. You know, look, if you're coming here from someplace else, say every 100 years and then every 50 years and then every 20 years, because you could see that there were long periods where there wasn't much change in our technology if you go back hundreds of years, thousands of years. But then after 1900, things changed very drastically. Radio, for one. Airplanes, you know, first airplane flight was 1903 in December. The Wright brothers flew 112 feet.
Yeah, they
did. Miraculous. But in World War One, there were planes shooting down other planes, and there were radios being used. So our technology took many leaps after that. And then you look at 1938. You look at Lindbergh's flight. Suddenly, these guys are flying all over the place. That was 1927. And the number of pilots tripled between 27 and 30. Lindbergh's flight just got everybody going. So what I'm saying is that you'd expect them to be much closer, paying attention much closer to what the heck are these idiots doing down there? And how rapidly is their technology changing? And certainly something you could observe just by flying around would have been ship movements, those huge convoys going across the Atlantic, going across the Pacific, what happened at Pearl Harbor. There were a lot of ships sunk at one time, and they were big ones.
Right.
You know, in our book, Science Was Wrong, incidentally, by Kathleen Martin and myself, came out this year, and it's listed on the website, www.stantonfriedman.com. But
right in
there, we talk about the fact that one of the many ways in which science has been wrong when the big shots say things that weren't true was Billy Mitchell said you could sink ships from airplanes. This is right after World War One. He was a pilot during World War One.
Mm-hmm.
He said the whole business of warfare has been changed. And he was practically laughed out of town. The Secretary of the Navy said, well, I'll stand on any ship he thinks he can sink. Ha, ha, ha. Well, November 29th, in 1941 was the Army-Navy football game. And there was a picture in the program of the USS Arizona, this huge, powerful battleship. And there was a comment made that nobody had ever sunk a ship from the sky. 8 days later, Pearl Harbor, and they sank, among many other ships, the USS Arizona, with 1,100 people dying on board that.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm saying, any visitor from elsewhere looking around this planet, holy cow, what are these guys doing? We forget, us younger people, well, not me, but you guys, that during World War II, we destroyed 1,700 cities. We killed 50 million of our own kind. This is activity that was observable and that would tell aliens two things. One, these guys are nuts. They're crazy. They're primitive. All they do is kill. And two, their technology is growing, growing, growing. First atomic bomb, you know, New Mexico, Trinity site, July 1945. First one used on people 3 weeks later or so in Japan, less than a week later, another one on Japan. And then I mentioned that H-bomb with the 3-mile-wide fireball, mushroom cloud, call it what you want.
Mm-hmm.
So what I'm saying is 42, which would have been after Pearl Harbor,
mm-hmm.
and after the bombings and slaughters had started pretty effectively, aliens stopping by, making their, you know, every 20-year report would have said, wow, things are changing.
Things
changing
are
rapidly.
They're really changing down there.
There's something about that idea, maybe just the charming idea of aliens stopping by every few decades, or maybe even every few hundreds of years, just to see what's going on. Again, to understand this phenomena, I think it will take a little bit deeper thought than that, because one of the problems, of course, that we have is if we're talking about an aircraft being propelled through space using any kind of technologies that we may know about, or even those perhaps yet to have been developed or even conceptualized here on Earth, nonetheless, there are going to be some serious hurdles that the intelligence behind whatever that technology is will have to get around. And distant travel through space from one end of the galaxy to another, I mean, this isn't an easy thing to do, and it's not the kind of thing that you can do overnight. People have theorized about colony groups. This is one reason I have often entertained the idea of artificial intelligence, because, of course, if we are going to try and create artificial forms of intelligence, it stands to reason that intelligent beings elsewhere in the universe would do so also. And if indeed there were a synthetic life form or a synthetic intelligence, then the amount of time spent in space traveling from one location to another in order to be able to observe life here on Earth or anywhere else for that matter, may not be of as great significance, again, to a synthetic life form. But you introduce biology into the equation and you've got a lot of problems there. And so again, trying to understand exactly what's going on here, there are a lot of questions that remain. And in this interview, in fact, of course, I had more questions for Stanton Friedman. So when we come back after this, we will resume our conversation. In fact, we will actually be concluding this somewhere in time moment from about 10 years ago, where I sat down on the anniversary of Pearl Harbor and had a conversation with the late, great Stanton Friedman on the subject of UFO research. I am Micah Hanks, and we will wrap up this archival interview when we return right after this. It is the Graylian Report. It is the final segment for this week's edition of the Graylian Report, wrapping up an archival conversation that we had some time ago with the late, great Stanton Friedman. And again, that is an often used expression when you've lost someone of true greatness, late and great. You could also say, I think with equal efficiency, Stan was literally the man. And he is a person, I think, who will always be remembered for his work with regard to ufology, and also just as a humanitarian, and also just as a generally good person. A person who, whether or not you agree with his version of the truth, again, his conception was basically that aliens were visiting us here. And that idea, of course, came about as a result of years and years of research into the UFO phenomenon. But again, his passion and his quest for truth, I think, are something truly to be admired. And I know I admired those things about Stanton Friedman. In this final segment, I wanted to ask him about disappearances related to UFO sightings. And we got into that, and he gives a very unique breakdown about a subject you don't hear an awful lot about. And that were a number of instances where aircraft and pilots have vanished in conjunction with UFO sightings. We'll continue that audio right now.
Stanton, do you recall in your research with ufology any similar instances where UFOs have been equated with the disappearance or perhaps even the death of an individual, and does that cause concern?
There's a whole book about Valentich by Dr. Richard Haynes, a former NASA scientist, now retired. He lives out on the West Coast. And I actually met Valentich's father on one of my trips to Australia. In the book, Shoot Them Down by Frank Ficino, which deals with events of 1952, which was the biggest year in Blue Book history, most sightings reported, etc., and which also included the Flatwoods, West Virginia monster case, which Frank is the world's expert on. Anyway, in that book, we point out, I wrote the foreword, and I worked with Frank on some other things in the book, and we reported that the official, there were orders issued officially to military pilots of the United States to shoot down UFOs if they didn't land when instructed to do so. Think of all kinds of cartoons that would fit that. And there was an Air Force general who admitted they'd been scrambled at least 300 times. Now, the reason I mention that is also in the book, and yeah, the book is listed on my website, www.stanfriedman.com. There is a listing of 200 cases in which military aircraft fatally crashed between 51 and like 55, 1955. These are from the New York Times. 200 cases. These are fatal crashes, not just accidents, but where the pilots died. And the New York Times occasionally used words like disappeared and disintegrated. Now, on seven different occasions, I have heard quietly, people weren't looking for attention, of cases where pilots had gone up and never come back. And so where did they go? I don't know. But disintegrated and disappeared? What's that got to do with airplane crashes? You know, I'll give you one example. I was out on the West Coast. The guy had been in radar up in Kalispell, Montana, in the early 50s. And they picked up a UFO heading their way from north, from Canada south. They happened to have a jet in the air at the time, and they vectored him toward the UFO. And they're watching on the radar screen as these two vehicles come closer and closer to each other. And then there's only one. Now, they know exactly what the altitude and the direction and speed of our jet was. They never found the plane.
My gosh.
So, and if, look, if I've heard of seven, there have to have been a lot. These included a couple of Navy cases, guys on aircraft carriers saying that the plane went up and never came back. So, you know, who grabbed them? I don't know. These are not cases where, as far as I can tell, they were intentionally offensive toward us, but I'd call it self-defense. Another case, it's an interesting one, a Navy pilot down in South Carolina. He was the only one on duty in the evening, plane ready to go. Radar people say, you know, there's an unknown up there. They scramble him. He gets up to 20,000 feet or so and looks around. Where the heck is the unknown? oh, there it is down there. Then it comes up toward him. And he's talking to the ground while this is going on, of course. And this thing comes right at him. And it's brilliant light heading toward him. He put his hand up, and he said he could see the bones in his hands.
What?
And you heard me. That's what he told me.
Oh, my gosh.
He was talking to the ground. They said, shoot it. And so he pulls the trigger, and nothing happens. Turns out the guns hadn't been loaded. The plane had been sitting there.
Oh, wonderful.
And we agreed that probably the only reason he was alive when I was talking to him, and this guy was a lawyer, incidentally, later in life, and pilot and so forth. I was very impressed with him.
Yeah.
But we agreed the only reason he was still alive was because the guns hadn't been loaded. But what can I say? In that Kalispell, Montana case, the guy tells me, he said, after that, we told the pilots to take pictures, do not shoot. And so there's a lot going on, and I think that's one of the reasons for the cover-up is the government doesn't want to admit that we have lost pilots chasing them. And people who think, oh, come on, they tell the family, Stan, what do you think? Well, there are 166 military guys who were crew members of planes that were tickling, is the word they used, the radar of North Korea, China, and Russia right after World War II. See how quickly the radar came on, you know? And these were loaded with reconnaissance gear and radio signal gear and so forth.
Right.
And we lost 166 men. And the families were all lied to, unfortunate accident at sea, sorry about that, until 2001, which is more than 50 years later for some of those families. They were called to a meeting and told and given the medals and told what happened to their sons, brothers, fathers, whatever. There's a book, By Any Means Necessary, by William Burroughs, that goes into this. And I mention it because here we have that many guys, military guys, on duty, being shot down, and not a word in public about that until umpteen years later. We shot down some Russian planes doing the same thing, again, without saying anything publicly. So governments can keep secrets. They will keep secrets. What all they know, we don't know, but they're perfectly capable of maintaining a huge amount of classified stuff.
And that's what we've been talking about tonight, you know, secrets. And obviously there are going to be some secrets that remain, especially pertaining to UFOs, that we, we just don't know. We may never know. Now, listen, Stan, we're almost out of time. Would you tell the listeners here on the program a little bit about how to find out more about what you do and how to keep up with you and your exploits?
Okay. If you go to my website, www.stantonfriedman.com, and it needs updating, but it does normally list my future activities, places where I'll be speaking. It lists all my books and DVDs. There are five my books, and you can buy all my books from Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble, Borders, or whatever, but you won't get my autograph. And the books by Kathleen Martin and I, you'll get both autographs. We use book plates. We don't ship the books back and forth. But between those and the DVDs, you can get Blue Book Special Report 14. You can get my report, Final Report on Operation Majestic 12, which includes a copy of Phil Colossus' check to me for $1,000 for proving him wrong about the typeface on one of the MJ-12 documents.
Well, I'd like to see that.
Worth the laugh. There's also a copy of the check in Flying Saucers and Science. So there's a lot of good stuff out there. It's easy to get, and it tells you how to reach me, too. Not only my website, but it gives you my email address, and there's some phone numbers around. So I don't give them out over the air because then my phone is swamped at that time, and I only got one line. And
sure.
So
I understand.
But they can get me. I'm on Facebook, but I don't use it. My wife uses it for family stuff, so they can get me using my email address, which is on the website. I do talk to communicate with people. What do you call it when you're communicating by email? It's not talking, not exactly writing.
Emailing?
Whatever it is.
Yeah. What? Emailing, maybe?
Well, that's too simple.
Of course
emailing
it is.
Emailing is right, but new form of communication, I guess. much more used than any other, I suppose. But what I'm saying is that I've made an effort to put stuff out there to challenge the debunkers. There are separate articles. There's a big one on government UFO lies, because there are a lot of them. That's on the website, too. I don't blog.
You don't blog. That's right. You leave it up.
Don't blog. I'm sorry. I'm too busy. And, you know, I don't even have a cell phone, because I like private conversation. If I'm going to be on the radio, I'll be on the radio. But the idea of standing around with a whole bunch of people listening to what I'm saying doesn't appeal to me.
Not as appealing. Well, Stanton Friedman, again, thank you so much for joining us here on the program. I got to turn you loose. Thanks again. We'll have you back sometime soon.
And that completes the interview. A little surreal, admittedly, listening back to this and hearing, again, Stanton talking about his life, his work. It's hard to believe that we've lost him. And when he passed away, of course, I was getting notes from people all over the world. You know, Micah, have you heard the news? And in truth, one of those people was my good friend Jim Harold. Jim had been at an event with him only days before Stanton passed away. And he said, I'm kind of in shock right now. I'm so glad I got to hang out with him. He said, we spent the whole day together and we got to talk a lot. And he was truly just a wonderful person. I know that everyone who had the pleasure of meeting Stanton Friedman felt that way. I certainly did. We'll always cherish his memory here on this program. And of course, we will always appreciate the great work that he did that was so influential in the study of unexplained aerial phenomena. Stanton Friedman, a great man and truly an icon in the field. And that'll have to be the final word for this edition of the podcast. And on behalf of all of us here at Grelian International Studios, including Chris Hayes, Caleb Hanks, Tyler Pittman, Jeremy London, Rayson Robin Hobbs, Dick Oakley, John Anderson, Jason Pintrail, James Waldo, Tiffany Mack, the lovely assistant Lauren, Mr. Grelian Reverend himself, Matthew Oakley, and of course yours truly, I am Micah Hanks. It is the Grelian Report, and we will catch you guys next time. In the meantime, as always, stay strange out there.